will come to order on this March 2nd of 2017. A quorum is present. Members, we're not going to approve the minutes because DFL House Research has noted, not House Research, DFL Researcher noted that I think we missed a place where the motion prevailed, so we want to make that correction. And I should have called that yesterday. I don't know why I did it, but thank you very much for calling that that to our attention. Members, today we have several bills on the agenda, and we're going to lead off with Representative Paul Anderson's Agricultural Educator Grant Program Established and Money Appropriated. Welcome to our committee, Representative Anderson. Representative Rarick moves House File 485 to be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Welcome to our committee, Representative Anderson. And would you proceed to explain House File 485?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 485, we think, looks at a situation that we feel strongly about in education, and especially ag education, which is really an area that's coming on strong and a lot of additional interest in ag education. In fact, this past year there were 17 positions that couldn't be filled by certified ag teachers. We had to have some community experts and variances issued to fill all of the vacancies in ag education. And the other irony of that situation is that a lot of their work, especially if they are an FFA advisor, there are summer projects and community gardens and things like that, and the instructors do a lot of work in the summertime when the crops are growing, things are happening, and a lot of ag teachers, frankly, aren't getting paid for the work they do in the summertime. So we had this bill last year with some one-time funding, and it really worked well. It's a one-to-one match. The school has to match the state grant on a dollar-to-dollar basis to help fund some summer extended contracts for ag teachers in our high schools, Madam Chair. And I have one testifier to talk about what it's like in ag education today.
And you have a testifier with you?
Yes.
Welcome to our committee, sir. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom Apple, and I'm currently the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Agricultural Educators.
Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, the organization I represent is composed of about 345 agricultural instructors across the state. That includes instructors at the university level, the post-secondary level, farm business management, and high school. The group that I want to address today is our high school component. We currently have 254 high school agricultural instructors in the state of Minnesota at the secondary level. Those instructors serve approximately 21,000 students during a typical year. If you look at agricultural program, there's a number of components to it that we think are vital to have a quality program. Obviously, there's the base 9-month instructional program during the course of the year. Some other pieces that are important, of course, is the FFA as an organization. I think most folks are familiar with that. We also have a component of supervised agricultural experience, where most of our students have some type of either crop, livestock, placement experience, some type of other educational individualized experience is what they have. And then the other piece that's really critical for us, and that's what we're here to discuss today, is our summer program and our extended contracts. We've got that 9-month program, and then as Representative Anderson said, we start out in the spring and the summer, and we have all of our crops and our livestock and our SAE projects for the students, and then there's a lack of time for our instructors to go ahead and visit those students and meet those needs. So it's really that summer piece that we're looking at. Due to the seasonality of agriculture, we think it's very important that we provide opportunities for our students to have experiences along those lines. Number of service projects, if you're familiar with it, a number of schools have started school gardens and farm-to-school projects over the last 5 to 7 years. We certainly have gone ahead and integrated a lot of science into our curriculum. I look at it and I say, okay, now the crops are starting to grow. We've got prepared exhibits for fairs. We've got our gardens, fruit trees. We've got all kinds of biological botany kind of things going on in the summer. It sure seems like an opportune time to go ahead and provide experiences for our students. I always kind of look at it and say, you know, one of the things that kind of culminates at the end of the summer is, of course, the Great Minnesota Get-Together. I stop and look at that activity, and I look at it and say, well, gee, we've got the miracle birth. If you've ever been there, most of you realize who a lot of the attendees are in there. our agriculture education students from our high schools. We refer to them as Barneys. You've heard a little bit about some of our concerns for farm safety and tractor driving. We have another event at the fair that, of course, is the tractor driving contest, along with our crops, our livestock exhibits, a lot of our mechanics projects. So we've got a lot of things that happen in the summer that are really an extension of that nine-month year, and that becomes a real concern for us. We've seen some trend changes in that. When I first started teaching, pretty much every agriculture instructor had a full three-month contract, which means they were compensated for 40 or 60 days during the summer because of the nature of the program. It's a program that really can't be compared with any other discipline in a district, so it's, we're kind of unique in that way. Those numbers have gone down, and we know it's been a trend the last 10 years. We as an agriculture association did a little survey in 2015 at our summer conference. We have some really young technology savvy instructors. They said, we're going to do a survey. Everybody pulled out their iPhones. We asked three questions. One of the questions we asked was, how much extended time do you have to provide opportunities for students? There's two pieces here that were really a concern for me. We had 37 programs that there was no extended time. They had 0 days that they were allowed to help them work with students. We broke that down into five-day increments, so I'm going to kind of focus on that 26-day or more because there was kind of a logical break there. We only had 18 schools that had 26 days or more. Keep in mind, historically, we used to have 40 and 60 days, so there's certainly been a real trend to take those away. Second question we asked is, how much time do you actually spend? Well, only 18 offered. We had 77 of our schools that the instructor puts in time. So, yes, it's volunteer, it's a commitment to the program, et cetera. And then the third question we asked is, what would be the reasonable, the most logical amount of time to spend? And 94 instructors thought that it would be 26 or more. So we have the demand. We kind of had the need there. At this point in time, as Representative Anderson said, we did a pilot program last year. We evaluated that program. We used the funds for last year. We believe that the next step is to go ahead and try to secure funding again and put a reasonable increase with that funding so that we may be able to provide opportunities and impact our students.
Thank you very much, sir. That was very thorough. Are there questions from members? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. Thank you for your testimony. I want to just ask if this wouldn't also be helpful for students across the state, not just agriculture, but the application. You mentioned mechanics, the science involved, and I'm a kind of a proponent of year-round school, so I think that what you're talking about is really taking advantage of the world around us and the rich learning environment that that provides. Does that make sense to you?
Mr. Apple.
Madam Chair? Yes, it certainly does. And agriculture, as I said, is kind of that unique program where if you look at how we've grown in the last 30, 40 years, we put a lot of science into it. There's certainly no reason that that couldn't be a possibility. We look at all the things that happen, and I think that would be a tremendous idea. Some of our programs actually do that. Most of our students, of course, have already had science. They're involved in social studies. They're involved in the agribusiness component. But I think that certainly does have some merit.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony on the bill. I have a question related to students being able to get credit in the summer. I represent District 21A, includes Goodhue County, which is a lot of ag area, and I've had comments from some of my constituents on because of our graduation requirements and all the other opportunities they have during the school year, that these types of programs, there's a lot of interest in them, but they'd also like it to be a credit-bearing class or credit-bearing opportunity. Is that something that you've thought of?
Mr. Apple.
Madam Chair, Representative, actually that does exist. I have retired or stepped out of the classroom. I don't like the retired word. I'll just say I stepped out of the classroom, cashed in a really good full-time job for two part-time jobs that take as much time as the full-time job. So there's my blurb on that. But I taught at Mount Lake for 35 years, and we offered summer credit all the time. Okay, I can't give you the actual number of schools that do that, but there are a number of schools that do offer credit in the summertime. The Department of Education years ago came out with some guidelines indicating here are the number of group hours you should have, classroom instruction, large group, and then we use the other component of our SAEs, where those students are having individual learning activities with their projects to do that. So that option already does exist. If a school district isn't doing that, that is something, if you want to, somebody can contact me or the Department of Education, we certainly can provide some guidelines and parameters for that school district to offer a summer credit.
Quick follow-up. So this getting this grant money isn't necessarily tied then to it being a credit-bearing course. Do I understand that right?
Mr. Apple.
Unfortunately, it's not.
Okay.
But on the flip side of it, if our instructors don't have the time, then it can't generate the credit, so it's kind of a double sort of a thing. I would hope that as we start to develop this and if we can secure this funding, that becomes an important component. And I get nervous, I say require something. But the students are there. They are learning. It's the practical education would be very, very valuable.
Closing comments, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think the subject has been covered very well, and appreciate the testimony. And in ag education, when you're around it with FFA students, the Blue Jackets up here last week, you can just sense the enthusiasm. And that goes for the instructors as well. It's just a fun area to be around. The demand is growing for jobs in agriculture. I think this is just an important area where we need to give our kids all that we can. And this program goes a little ways in incentivizing schools. You know, they have tight budgets. We all know that. But to help them offer these summer hours. So thank you, Madam Chair and members.
With that, Representative Rarick renews the motion that House File 485 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members.
Representative Baker, welcome to our committee. Representative Erdahl offers House File 535, and this bill will be and we have an amendment, I see. But it will be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Representative Erdahl, will you offer the DE1 amendment?
I will offer that amendment, yes.
Representative Erdahl offers the DE1 amendment to House File 535. I'm going to ask the author, after he introduces himself, to please explain the delete all. Welcome to our committee.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much. This is this
will bill you say
is,
your name for the
I'm purpose? Sorry. Representative Dave Baker, representing District 17B, which is the home district of this school, Madam Chair. Today I bring forward the bill for Prairie Lake School. It's a treatment. It's a care and treatment facility, and what we're looking for is to get some summer help, some summer school for these kids that are in the school that have actually been, been through a lot in their life. They are there because of bad choices, and they have been there because of family situations, and they are just they need to be detained. But going to school is super important. So these kids have a need to continue to go to school in the summertime. In the past, we've had some grants that have allowed that to happen, and those have ended. The school districts have worked really hard to make that continue, but they just literally can't do it any longer until we get some help from the Department of Education. And so this amendment, Madam Chair, works with the Department of Education, helps us get the language that they like to have. They are here to testify if you so choose to have them here to support that. But we're looking for just the support, Madam Chair, to continue this very important school in our area for these kids that really need to get caught up with their credit so they have a chance to graduate on time. So,
thank you for that explanation. Representative Erdahl renews his motion that the DE1 amendment be adopted to House File 535. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. And now we have the bill in its order that you wanted it. Is there anything more that you need to offer, because you have a testifier
who
I think can explain very well what we're up to?
Yes.
Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Linda Bott. Thank you for giving us this time to be here. I am the administrator for alternative programs in Willmar, and I just wanted to speak on behalf of our students. That's why we are here. It's because of our students. Our students come from all over the state. They are placed there by court order. they're there. We go through about 400 students a year. Most of them outstate. Once in a while, we get someone from Wilmer. One of the things that we are finding that we feel that summer programming is very important because we find that our students have been in multiple placements. I have an example of a student just came in this past year, has been in 10 placements already. They come to us, and when you go look at their transcript, they have partial credit, partial credit, partial credit. When these kids go back to a traditional school, those classes do not count. They need to take them all over because they are not complete. One thing that we can do for the students, especially if we can get a summer programming, is we take those students, we look at each individual student, where are they at, and complete those credits. When those kids come to us and they have those partial credits, they're moved further from graduation, not closer, even though they've been in multiple schools all year. So our goal for these students is to get them to a place where they have some full credits. They're moving towards graduation because our goal for these students is maybe for many of them, the first one in their family to graduate from high school. And we want our students to be productive citizens, and that's our goal. And the way we can do that is by getting them that summer time for them to get that catch-up time that they've lost. And as you've heard, many of them are there by core placements. Many of them are products of their environment. We have students that told us this is the best Christmas I've ever had. I have three meals a day. I feel safe. I know where I'm going to sleep. And when they have all of those pieces in place, we know education can take place as well. When we don't have that in place, when they're in multiple placements or in different homes, they are not feeling safe. We know when they're at school, we cannot have their very best when they're at school. We don't have the very best of them at that time. And right then, they're in survival mode. So we are asking for summer funding so that we can take these students, move them forward towards graduation in a safe, secure environment so that our goal can be met with graduation and productive citizens in our communities throughout the state.
Thank you very much. Would you spell your last name for us, please?
Yes, B-A-H-E.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from members? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd just like to comment that I've been in this school, actually with Mr. Anderson, who is also here today, one of the teachers there, and I've spent a couple of hours telling the students how this place works, or doesn't work, depends on your point of view. But I think it's a very valuable program to have this learning continue through the summer. These kids are ones that are in need of success, and this program helps to ensure that they can be successful. At least they have the opportunity to succeed in something when much of their lives they've been failing. So I encourage that we find ways to continue this program.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. I have a similar facility and visit with the young men all the time about their movement towards success, and it's always so exciting that they can continue their education. One other who would like to lend a note. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Darren Anderson, and I'm one of the teachers at Prairie Lakes Education Center and Lake Park School. This program is really important, the summer programming. As Linda Baha just said, a lot of these kids struggled in school. They weren't successful. And this gives them an opportunity to learn. That's the most powerful tool that these kids could have, is an education. Now, with your permission, Madam Chair, I have a letter here from one of the students that I'd like to read. It's better to come from a student than from a teacher, of course. This is one of our students who you'll find in their words didn't have a lot of success, and this program in the summer, especially during the summer, helped change things for them. My name is Tommy, and I'm a student currently enrolled in the Wilmer Public Schools through PLYP. My goal in writing this letter is to tell you my story of how this school has changed my life. I'm 17 years old, and I've been through four different schools, including this one, within my high school career. I'm not proud of it, but I'm going to be completely honest and say that I did not have a single care for an education. It was not even of the slightest importance to me. I struggled in many of my classes and eventually became a dropout by the age of 16 with no ambition or goals for ever getting an education. That was until I became a student of this school program. I was first enrolled at the beginning of the summer of 2016, which became my turning point. It was not only the way I was taught, but also the way the teachers worked with me and encouraged me in every class. Most schools I attended would tell me it was fine if I didn't care. They told me that it would be on me in the end. Here, the teachers never gave up on me. It's not that they told me I absolutely had to get that education, but they let me know that it wasn't impossible, that no matter how behind I was or how much I struggled, I wasn't any less than any other kids in the world, nor did I deserve any less. For me, this was the best school I have ever been in because they not only inspired me, but they took the time to teach me and get me back on track and caught up on my credits. Now I'm an A or B student with math and reading levels as high as a college student. I used to stare at the wall and wonder if an education was even worth the time. Now I spend my time thinking about what I want to start my career in after high school and college. I've even had other kids ask me for help on schoolwork, and it's a great feeling to know that I've come so far, and my thanks has to go to this school. I now believe that I can make a difference in this world, and I wouldn't be where I am if I hadn't had this school take the time to teach me over that summer. That one summer changed my whole life and my outlook on it. This is my story, and I thank you for taking the time to read it.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Yeah. So this tells you a lot of these students don't succeed. A lot of these students have given up. This summer program doesn't just educate these kids in math, science, and social, but it also gives them some hope. And I want to emphasize that this program is different than any other. We actually at Prairie Lakes have been a model for the entire state. We've had other schools, other counties come through and see how we run it. We run math and science, social, English, and it's not just myself as a social studies teacher. I don't just teach a blanket social studies. I teach these kids government. I've had Representative Erdahl in many times, and these kids are just in awe that a state representative would come and talk to them, listen to them. And actually, I had one student want me to pose a question to Representative Erdahl, and when I got an answer, she about hit the floor because a representative took the time to listen to their concern. Now, besides just American government, I teach economics, geography, and American history. So these kids get the full gamut. This is a high school program. One last little thing here, and I'll take your questions, of course. To give an example of how important the summer programming is it gets these kids caught up. We've had a few instances of kids that wanted to get the GED because they were so far behind in credits. And when the summer programming was over, they found out they were 2 credits short from graduation. That GED went out the window. They thought, I'm not getting that. I'm getting my diploma. I'm going to be the first one in my family. I had a young girl a few weeks ago that wants to get her GED. She said, I'm too far from graduating. I said, how many credits short are you? She goes, well, I'm 13 credits short. I said, well, think about this. At the end of May, you'll be down to 6. Yeah? I said, okay. Well, when we finish the summer programming, you'll have it all. Mm-hmm. Oh. That gave her hope. So this summer program is so important. And as a teacher, I am their voice. And I want to continue to be their voice. And that's why I've worked so hard on this, to help give these kids a second chance. The most touching thing that I get as a teacher, a lot of these kids struggle and they don't know how to handle positive reinforcement or things that are positive. I ran into a student at the Mall of America about 3 months ago. 4 years after this student was at Prairie Lakes, and he stopped me and goes, do you teach at Prairie Lakes? I said, yeah, because I thought so. He said, I've never told you this, but you made an impact in my life. If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be where I am. I'm in college right now. I'm straight. I'm clean. Mm-hmm. You made a huge impact on my life. And I thought to myself, wow, you don't hear that every day. And to run into them, of all places, at the Mall of America, with how many thousands of people. So I thank you this morning for the time to listen to our bill, and thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Anderson. We know what an influence teachers have in students' lives. There's nothing different from it than the power that years later they realize you had. Representative Pryor has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe the question is to you. I mean, it sounds like this is a, you know, a great opportunity that you have this group of students that are by court order in the facility, but that to continue education essentially year-round and not have that downtime. Are there other facilities that schools in the state like this that also we should be thinking about if they should there should be extended hours in summer programming?
Representative Pryor, there are other schools who would like to have this extended time during the summer. Yes, I have one of them, a care and treatment center, yes, that would like to go in that direction. So I think it's something we're going to be working on. Thanks for the question. Mr. Anderson.
Yes, Madam Chair, we've had that question posed to us before. It's different in the sense of we used to be considered an ALC, and our classification was changed 2 years ago to care and treatment. So that's why, again, we're here, because we did lose that summer programming. I asked our program director, Prairie Lakes Youth Programs, the detention center itself. There are only 9 in the state that are detention and corrections. But we classify it under care and treatment, where you have 50 other programs. But we have to understand that those care and treatment facilities, some of them are chemical dependency. Some of them are just group homes where a transition between an adoption or a transition out into society. But there are about 9 care and nine detention center / detention or corrections in the state. I have an example too, not so much an example, but where we classify. There's a care and treatment facility in my hometown of Litchfield that is run through a special ed cooperative and not a school district. So that's where our separation is. We are run by the school district, by the Wilmer Public School District, and not a special education cooperative. So it gets kind of muddled in trying to explain what's the difference between, you know, care and treatment in the detention centers. But I can say confidently there are about 9 in the state. They all talk. And I asked that question to our director in Wilmer, and he said, there's 9. How many run schools? Well, they all run schools. But you have to remember, there's only 9 detention corrections and not the others. So there's others, but we are in a small group that got lumped into a larger group.
And mine is contracts with the Onania School District, the Mille Lacs Academy, but they just long to have this continuation. So
we are familiar with that.
Representative Ward, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very, very grateful for the opportunities that you're giving kids. And it's clear, as we've heard from other experiences that people have had, that we need to give options to children, young people as they grow. So my question is, when they finish with your program, mm-hmm. and you mentioned one student still had 2 credits to go, mm-hmm. where do they graduate from? Do they, from Wilmer, or do they go back to their home district? Where do they graduate from?
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot of students want to get their graduation credits, or graduate, I should say, from their home district. And so we work with the home district to ensure that that happens. The one student I was referencing to, one that was 2 credits short, was from St. Cloud. The other one, I don't know which school district it was, of course, but she would have been graduating from a home district. Now, Wilmer is a much different school district. Well, it's not real different, but they run a block system, so there's... And they say you need 50, I think it's 58 credits?
Yeah, we have
some okay. Okay, so about 58 credits to graduate from rural schools, because they have a block schedule. So they load up all these credits, some are 24. If they're really far from graduating, we'll work to see which one is the best option. Maybe Wilmer's is the best option, maybe their home district is. So we try to get them to graduate from their home district, but if that's not possible, we try to get with the Wilmer School District to get them to graduate, because, again, we're right there, and we can get things done a little bit quicker and easier rather than waiting to get a response back.
Yeah. Closing comments, Representative Baker.
We want to help a lot more Tommies out there. So it was a really beautiful story, and, again, I want to thank our great teachers here to do this. So mm-hmm. with that, Madam Chair, I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Baker. And Mr. Anderson, please, if you ever see Tom again, tell him how much we appreciated his salute to you and all of our great teachers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I I will let him know. I appreciate everybody taking the time to
thank you. Representative Erdahl renews his motion that 535, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is moved to Education Finance.
Thank you so much.
Representative Drazkowski. Welcome to our committee, Representative Drazkowski. Representative Barr moves House File 1421 to be re-referred to, to be laid over for possible inclusion in a possible omnibus bill, Representative Drazkowski. You know how that works. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin. And members, there's going to be a video here. The volume may get a little bit loud at times, so be aware. Please say your name for the record and welcome again.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think this is my first time, Madam Chair, before the Education Policy Committee. I hope I have the terms correct here, Madam Chair. So the bill provides that schools may hold learning days, e-learning days, on days when there's inclement weather in Minnesota. And with us today, we have two individuals. We have Mr. Dave Anderson, who is a principal at Zumbrota Mazeppa School, and Angela Heitman, who is a teacher and a parent. They're actively involved in this curriculum that they do. And if you read the bill, members, it's a pretty simple bill in terms of how it's laid out, but it essentially gives authority to districts to not only do these days and to provide a structure for how that agreement happens within the school, but also provides that those days are counted in student contact hours or part of the ADM, as you see on the final section of the bill. So that's my introduction of the bill, Madam Chair, and maybe we want to go directly to our testimony.
And Representative Drazkowski, you are competing with me on this proposal. Mine was much thinner, fewer words, but I wanted to hear yours, not mine. So thank you very much for bringing forth the same concept with a little more detail. Welcome to our committee, Principal Anderson. Do you want to lead off?
Yep, thank you, Madam.
Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Dave Anderson. I am the principal at Zumbrota Mazeppa Middle School and High School.
And would you like to proceed to provide testimony to why this is such a great proposal?
Yes, Madam Chairwoman. This concept started in our district in the fall of 2015. We had a new superintendent in our district who met with our teachers' union and came up with the idea that, you know, if we have a snow day, that we still should be able to provide an education to our students. He met with the teachers' union, administration, teachers' union, and came forth with a plan that we would provide some sort of education to our students in the event of inclement weather, which this year southern Minnesota has been socked with a few instances of that. So the teachers union was definitely on board with the idea that the concept of a snow day being a quote free day and nothing goes on anymore, the ability for kids to continue to do coursework provided by their teachers was very well received, not only by our teachers but by our parents as well. So at Zumbrota Mazeppa, our policy is pretty simple. The first snow day we have is not a wild day, and wild stands for weather-induced learning day. So our wild days simply mean that we provide education to our kids in the event of a snow day. We just had one last week, in fact, where we knew going from Thursday night and Friday the potential for anywhere between 2 and 14 inches of snow was going to arrive. So the superintendent, Mr. Anger, enacted the plan saying in the event of a wild day or snow day, we were going to go to wild day policy, which is kids knew full well, take their Chromebooks home. We're a one-to-one district in Zumbrota Mazeppa, so our students have access to Chromebooks. Our all grades 5 through 12 also has access to Schoology, which is an online platform, so they have all their curriculum loaded there as well. So it's been very positive from an administrator standpoint. It's been very positive, the feedback from our parents, and I will turn it over to one of our teachers to talk about her experience with it.
Welcome, Ms. Heitman. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Okay. My name is Angela Heitman. I teach at Zumbrota Mazeppa Schools, and I have children in the district as well. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I was also a part of that committee that met, and we met several times to discuss the pros and cons of it as well, just because of the different issues that can come up with that. But we do get hit with some weather, obviously, and one of the components we talked about was that in the event of that loss, we would either take away certain days that were a part of the schedule or add on at the end of June, which then there's a break in that learning. And so that was the biggest thing. As a teacher, they can continue what we're on, like the subject that we're on. So I teach biology, and we can't do the labs like in school, but there's something out there that is supplemental. And usually it's something that I could take that I wouldn't have necessarily had time for in the classroom, but then they can do something different that is supplemental to our particular curriculum at that time. As a parent, I have a fifth grader and a junior, and they're different. The junior is doing subject-level work, and so his is the same thing. Whatever that subject is, they have something different, and it could be 10 minutes, it could be 45 minutes of what he's working on, and then the fifth grader, my fifth grader has a bingo sheet, the subjects, and he just picks one from each column, and if we didn't have this, then he might have been a little more stationary at home. Like he might have still played outside, but this gives him some more things to do, which I'm not opposed to at all. I'll give you an example. In class, we bred fruit flies, and so that's something that's hands-on. I can't send them home with that, so obviously I cannot do that, but I found a virtual lab of that, and then they got several components of development of that and the genetics piece of it. So to me, it's only helpful because I wouldn't have time for that in the classroom, 44 minutes.
Thank you, Ms. Heisman. You're proving the ingeniousness of teachers when they need to have a fallback. There's always a creative idea someplace to cover for the content that is needed for our children to continue to learn. Are there questions from members? Yes, Representative Kudish-Padin.
I really like this idea. I'm a teacher. I'm a library and media specialist. My district has the one-to-one program as well. So I'm in charge of getting 1,400 Chromebooks out to middle school students and keeping up with the Schoology as well. So this is a great program, and I can only see how much of an opportunity this is. My one question is, I know that your area is very rural. So how does what do you do if a family doesn't have access to the Internet or something like that?
That's a great question.
Mr. Anderson.
That's a great question, and I'm glad you brought that up. Being a rural district, as you pointed out, not all of our kids have access to Wi-Fi or have access to Internet at home. So our teachers have been more than accommodating to our students that, look, if you can't do it online in a Schoology platform or a Google Docs platform, that paper is certainly acceptable, that these kids are certainly given the opportunity to complete that work outside of an electronics. And I also want to point out that our teachers at our district are tremendously flexible. So if we have a snow day on a Friday, they're very gracious about making sure the kids have ample time to get that item in. It isn't just that the school day ends at 3:10 on a Friday and it happens to be an inclement weather day. That work isn't necessarily has to be done at that 3:10. They can have all weekend to work. And I know that some of our teachers from last Friday's snowstorm are still, getting some work turned in as of yesterday and the day, even today online. So we definitely make concessions for our kids who don't have technology access.
Representative.
Does your district provide hotspots for students? Is that opportunity?
Principal Anderson.
At this point, no, we don't necessarily provide hotspots.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Ruskowski, you probably didn't know that you were supposed to bring treats if you've never been in this committee before. It's not my rule. It happens to be staff rule, so I forgive you, and you don't need to bring them. But what you saw being passed out is coming from our next author, Representative Anselmo. So I hope you didn't think the cupcakes were just a traditional we have.
Well, Madam Chair, I could have fibbed and said that there was coordination between me and Representative.
Well, you could, yes. And he probably would agree that would be okay. Closing comments, Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We also have a video, Madam Chair, if we could take a look. It's very, very good.
Thank you. And before you do that, Representative Lee, you had a question. I'm sorry, I missed you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was just curious, do you track attendance, too, if you do have the school day?
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. That's a great question. We do track attendance, and we count every kid as present to start the day, and then we work on the fact that, you know, their presence is that they're doing something, that they're actually completing the work that they are asked to complete.
So now we have the production. Yes, Principal Anderson.
Before I show this, I just want to preempt to say this is a video example of our 7th grade team. It's a cross-curricular assignment, so all four of our 7th grade teachers got together to make this video for all of our 7th graders for their Wild Day assignment.
Hey, 7th graders, for your Wild Day assignment today, we're going to be focusing on maple syruping, and we're using the book Little House in the Big Woods by Laura Ingalls Wilder. Hey, Mrs. Bradley, who's Laura Ingalls Wilder?
Graders, as you know, we recently finished our nonfiction unit. So, for your Wild Day assignment, I want you to go on the Schoology and read the article on Laura Ingalls Wilder. Then, I want you to choose 5 interesting facts about her and write a 2-paragraph summary on her life. Now, I will be grading you on 3 things. First of all, your ability to distinguish fact from opinion. Next, your ability to write a cohesive summary. And last, that you can put these items in chronological order. When you're done, please upload your assignment onto Schoology. Have fun!
So we're here with a maple tree, and the sap from the maple tree is kind of like the maple tree's blood, if you will. It comes from the ground up all the way to the branches, to the very tips of the branches, as described in the Little House in the Big Woods, and it is what allows the tree to make leaves. So as the tree prepares to make the leaves early in the spring, like we are now, we can tap the tree and harvest just a little bit of the sap that's moving up and down the tree. So if you look here, we're using 3 taps in this tree. The taps are small plastic taps. This end goes into the hole that's drilled in the tree, and this end gets hooked to the tubing for the sap to drain out. We hook the tubing together with these 3-piece or 3-part hookups, these T-junctions, that hooks the different tubings together as it heads down into the bucket. Use your document on your history page in Schoology to compare and contrast how we collect maple syrup today with how Laura Ingalls Wilder did it in her book. We collect the sap in the buckets. Hey, Mr. Johnson, why is the sap sweet?
Great question, Mr. Morris. It's photosynthesis, of course. Now we're going to do a little review on photosynthesis. You're going to play Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. All you need to do is go to my Schoology page. It'll be in your Wild assignment, just like normal. And remember, for your math assignment, tree plus tree equals sticks.
Now that we have the sap, we'll head over to the evaporator. Sap is 97% water, so we're going to have to boil off a lot of it to get down to syrup. Hey, Mr. Moe, how much sap are we going to need?
Mr. Morris has told you that sap is 97% water. That means it's going to take about 40 parts sap to make 1 part syrup. With the information that we gathered with our volume of the bucket and the pan, there's questions on Schoology that need to be answered using those measurements and using the ratio of 40 to 1. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That was really, really fun to watch and great for the students, you know, because you just didn't make it complicated. They could understand it and
follow your directions. Very good. Representative Kudish-Padin, yes, follow up.
One more question. On those wild days, are teachers expected to be at school? Or are they able to stay home and work with this at home?
Ms. Heitman. Okay, thank you. I stay at home, and then I check it routinely throughout the day, and then as it makes it easier for me, but I'm not sitting at my computer, but as I check it and I read there or whatever their submissions are, then I mark their attendance. And so it's, you know, if they have a question, it's right there up for me, but I don't have to be at school.
Mm-hmm. Representative, follow-up?
No.
I'm good, thank you. Representative Bennett, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to make this quick, but you've got my curiosity up as a former teacher. What are the logistics of trying to put this together? Obviously, the teachers don't do it on the snow day. So do they prepare, you know, a number of lessons ahead of time for those potential snow days, or how do they coordinate all that?
Ms. Heitman.
Okay. And I kind of wrote that down earlier, and I forgot to tell you, each subject or grade level is going to be a little bit different. Like the bingo card, they changed. Once they have one for the fifth grade, then they change it for the next one, so they're varying up the activities. I wait until I see right where we're at with the lessons that I'm at and what we've accomplished and what unit we're on. And so it depends grade level and subject level.
Representative Pennant, follow up? Thank you. Representative Jaskowski, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your indulgence in this bill, and I hope you can we can gain your support for it. It's a bill that encourages innovation, and it keeps teachers teaching, keeps students learning, and may even be good on the taxpayers, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And when it was heard in the Senate, were you the two who testified as well? Do you know Representative Jaskowski?
Madam Chair, I believe that was a different bill or a different effort.
Oh, okay. Thank you. With that, members, Representative Barr renews his motion that House File 1421 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you. Members, all in favor say aye. And I guess that we don't have to vote on it, but and the motion prevails to make sure that it is laid over. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you very much for taking time for your school to come to us today. Representative Anselmo. You have certainly earned your right to come to the chair, having treated the members. So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to our committee.
We got the treats that we brought here. As everyone knows, it's a freshman tradition, and happy to do that. We have cupcakes here from one of our lovely grocery stores in Edina, and I didn't bring that just because.
So why don't you introduce yourself, and then you can elaborate on where the cupcakes came from.
I'll do that. My name is Dario Anselmo. I'm a state representative in 49A for Edina here to introduce the bill.
And how about the bakery?
Bakery is Jerry's grocery stores. We are lucky to have three grocery stores in Edina with Lund's, Byerly's, and Jerry's. We brought cupcakes. As most people know, in Edina, we start out our day with cake in the morning, and we progress from there. So I'm going to continue that stereotype. I think there's also another reason, too. One of my favorite committee chairs, I think, also has a birthday today, too. So I thought it would be a good way to kick off that morning. So,
well, thank you very much.
So happy birthday.
Thank you. Representative Haley moves House File 1083 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Anselmo, please explain 1083.
Sure. The bill 1083 is a bill that is looking to modify open enrollment priority policy for students that are looking to attend a school district that has received more applications than are available. In our community, like a number of other ones across state, they are separated by district lines that were drawn up years ago that don't align with children who may naturally want to attend. Ourselves, when we lived just outside of the school district, I can remember the anxiety that we had to go through and waiting to find out if our third child would be able to attend the school that her fellow students did. This bill simply is helping connecting kids to their community schools. And I'm going to take this time now to introduce my testifier, Alan Kohler, who lives in Edina and has worked tirelessly on this issue for a number of years, and let him explain the details.
Thank you very much, and welcome, Mr. Kohler. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Alan Kohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to testify this morning on behalf of this bill. While I currently am a resident of the city of Edina, while I was growing up, my family lived in Grand Rapids and Northfield, two cities where the city and the school district are effectively the same. As an adult, I found myself in Edina where that is not the case, and I have spent past 7 years trying to understand better both district boundaries and also open enrollment and the interplay between the two, and that's my testimony today. I do have some maps I'll be going through, and I hopefully they're in your packets this morning.
Yes, members, there is a packet in your packet.
Because sometimes when you describe it in words, it's a little bit harder to understand than when you see it in imagery. And so I like to start with some maps and also some photos to better explain why 1083 has been put forth to you. So I have about six maps starting on page three, the first one being the Prior Lake Savage School District. So on all these maps, we are using school district maps and then showing portions of the cities which are outside of those boundaries. So on the map on page three, you see portions of Prior Lake, the city of Prior Lake, which extend beyond the district boundaries of Prior Lake Savage. Map four shows a portion of Albertville, city of Albertville, which is beyond the St. Michael Albertville School District, as well as two portions of the city of St. Michael, which are outside the same district. Page five, and again, I apologize for my amateurish cartography skills, but this is the best I could do to try to illustrate. Page five shows portions of the city Orono, which are outside the Orono School District. Page six shows a portion of the city of Roseville, which is outside the Roseville School District, as well as a portion of the city of Little Canada, which is outside the Roseville School District. Map 7 shows a portion of the city of New Brighton, a portion of the city of Arden Hills, and a portion of the city of North Oaks, all of which are outside the Mounds View School District. And finally, on page 8, this is the map of the district of Edina, and then the portions of the city of Edina, which are outside the school district. Now, what all these are not exclusive of all the examples in the state of Minnesota, but what all these share in common is that the remainder of the cities are all within a single school district, and only one school district operates schools within those cities. So in all these maps, the portion in orange is outside the district which serves the remainder of the city, and there are no schools in those orange areas. So in effect, children and families often want to open enroll into the district which serves the remainder of their cities. There are no local schools in those areas, yet they are often then subject to the vagaries of the open enrollment lottery process. I myself experienced that when our oldest daughter was entering kindergarten, when due to the volume of applicants that year, she was not able to open enroll into Edina School District, even though we lived two houses away from the boundary line. And we were able to open enroll the next year, but that meant she had a year at a different school. And this is all a common experience that kindergartners share in a new school. And even as parents, we miss a lot of the common experiences parents share. As your first child enters school, you do a lot of bonding, you do carpooling, you do a lot of common experiences. And for our family, we've noticed a very dramatic experience between that of our first child, who was not able to open enroll as a kindergartner, and then our second child, who was able to open enroll as a sibling. Very different experiences. On page 9, I just want to show you, move from a 10,000-foot view down to a street-level view and what it actually means when you live in these portions of the city outside the school district. On page 9, these are two pictures of Pine Grove Street, which is about 2.5 blocks long, and the school district boundary runs right down the middle of the street. This is, as you see, it's not a busy street. It actually dead-ends in a cul-de-sac, terminates on Blake Road on the top picture. Yet if the kids on the left go to one school district and the kids on the right go to another one. Page 10 shows two examples where the boundary actually runs through side yards. So in the top picture, the house on the left is in the United School District. The house on the right is in the Hopkins School District. Huh. And on the bottom, the house on the right is in the Hopkins School District. The house on the left is the United School District. Finally, on page 10, this is another example where actually the boundary runs to adjoining backyards. So in the picture on the top, the houses on the right are the United School District. The houses on the left are the Hopkins School District, and vice versa on the bottom. Now, I took these pictures from the street. As you get deeper into the block, there's often no barriers at all between the yards. There aren't these rows of trees. It's just open grass. Yet, in the middle of the open grass, there's a boundary line that separates two different school districts. And what we've seen, personally, we've seen others in our neighborhood, and I'm sure it happens in other communities, but it's about other maps, is that, you know, your first 4 or 5 years as you raise a child, you're preparing them for school. And part of that preparing for school is how to play with others, how to develop friendships. But when you live in situations like this, you don't know where your child's going to go to school. You hope that they can go to school with the kids on the other side of the lawn, but you don't know. And you speak to your kids differently when you don't know, because they're like, where am I going to go to school next year? Well, we hope you can go over there, but we're not sure. We've often experienced in our neighborhood, too, as well, that often parents don't know that they've been open enrolled until 3 or 4 days before school year starts. Now, some kids are very malleable, and they're fine with that. Some kids need a lot of preparation where you trial drive to the school, and you walk around the playground, and you get them prepared because this is a huge step for them. And suddenly, 3 days before school starts, you're telling them, actually, you're going to a different school now. And often in cases, the school that you are allowed to open enroll to isn't the one that serves the local neighborhood. It's just another school that has capacity. So sometimes you're open enrolling your child to a different school in the district and then moving them yet again intra-district a year later. So this just brings a lot of challenges that families have to deal with simply because in the open enrollment statute, there's a lot of thou shalt nots. Thou shalt not, and there's criteria of how you can not exclude a applicant from being open enrolled. But the Department of Education has been very emphatic that the thou shalls have to be specifically stipulated in the state statute language. And so over the past couple of years, there's been specific language added to give priority to students who are trying to open enroll through an integration achievement plan. There's been specific language added so that siblings can get a priority if they're trying to open enroll. And last year, there was specific language added so that children of district staff can get a priority trying to open enroll. And all these, they make good sense. You're trying to keep families together. You're trying to keep, in the case of district staff, if a parent is traveling to a district, they'd like their children to be there as well. And what we're asking you in support of this bill is to help neighborhoods to stay together in these unique situations where boundaries that were created 60 and 120 years ago can somehow divide a neighborhood or create a great deal of uncertainty as to where the children actually will attend school when they reach that age. So that's the testimony I have for you this morning. I appreciate your time, and we'll be willing to take any questions you may have. Thank you.
Representative Pryor has a question.
So I live in Minnetonka. My kids went to Hopkins High School and Hopkins Schools. So it's confusing to me when you say local school because it's arbitrary where my city is and where my school district is. I'm probably about a quarter of a mile from the Minnetonka School District boundary, but I'm even closer to the local elementary school that's part of the Hopkins School District. So it just, it's to some degree, all of these boundaries are arbitrary, are they not? And your neighborhood can be divided by city and by school district at the same time, or it could just be school district. We also have, in my district, we have Eden Prairie School, that if you live in Eden Prairie, you could go to Minnetonka or you could go to Hopkins. Again, these are just, you know, I mean, we're all over the map in terms of school district versus city. So I'm not sure, in terms of keeping neighborhoods together and how this would bring clarity to us when all over the metro area, school districts and city boundaries are not necessarily lining up because, you know, just when they were done. So, and then also how this comes into play, you know, versus other reasons the way this is written, it sounds like you could start putting kids that happen to live in a city preference them over someone that's coming because of equity need and because of, as it says in the approved integration and achievement plan. So are we just saying, well, you know, because you're in Edina, you get preference over the child from Minneapolis?
Mr. Kohler.
Madam Chair, I think there's actually three questions in there, so I'll try to take them one at a time. This picture shows, if you're in the Edina School District in these backyards, you have, within a mile of you, you have an elementary school, you have a junior high, you have a high school, all within 1 mile. Conversely, if you're going to the resident district, you have an elementary school about 2 miles away, and then a middle school and a high school about 6 miles away. So, and I'm not saying in every map I showed you, in every instance, is the concept of local the same, because, yeah, proximity does change as you move across the map. But for a lot of these families, you know, going from everything within 1 mile to 2.5 to 6 miles is a big difference, particularly if you're trying to be involved in the school, you're running back and forth to schools all the time. So this bill does not create an entitlement. It just creates a priority. Now, I'll address your third question next. As the bill is written, the children who, if there is a limited amount of space and the school district moves to a lottery, siblings would get the first, and then there is a ranking order. And I'm sorry, I didn't have this better memorized. We're following at the end of the ranking order. So as you work through the lottery process based on limited capacity, that's the way it would work. So we're not trying to preempt anything else that's already been established. Again, it's a priority that gets slotted in before it's open to the general population. Now, just because I think you have a question coming, I'll try to preempt it a little bit. In the Edina School District, there's about 1,300 students that are open enrolled on an annual basis, or, you know, K-12. If every child in those areas I showed on the map were enrolled in the Edina School District, every single one, that's about a little over 700. So there's still 600 spots available for all the other, all the other categories get priority first. Then these, and then there'll still be 600 spots for kids from all other districts to open enroll as well. So, and the third one is, you're right, in some cities in the state, there are a multitude of districts that cover a geographic area. And, you know, there is history why that happens, and I'm not going to bore you with it unless you really would like to know it. But really what it comes down to is there were two eras of expediency, as I call them, in the 1890s and the 1950s. In the 1890s, as districts were first being formed, they would ask the farm families, where do you want to go to school? And the expediency was, what's closest, because my kids are either walking or going on horse. And in the 1950s, the era expediency was you had the building boom and you had the baby boom. And the building boom required people to get hooked up to municipal services as quickly as they could, city and water, you know, sewer and water. And the baby boom required access to a high school as quickly as you could, because a lot of these areas had common school districts that were K-8, and they needed to somehow get 9-12, and they needed it now, because the kids were banging on the door of the schools. In the Minnetonka geographical area, up until 1957, Minnetonka was a township. And as a township, you had no ability to block property from being annexed into an established municipality. And at the same time, you had school districts trying to create more of a unified school district and pulling in the common districts that only had one single building. And so that's kind of the history that that created this mishmash in some places of municipal boundaries and district boundaries not aligning. But in both the 1890s and the 1950s, there wasn't a lot of future thinking being put into these decisions. It's like, we have a problem we need to solve today. How are we going to solve it today? And so this bill is trying to address situations like the map show, where on the periphery we have these kind of zones where it's really difficult, and without totally redrawing boundary lines, how do you offer a little bit of relief to people who are finding themselves in these situations?
Thank you, Mr. Cole.
So thank you for the question.
I think that Representative Kunesh-Kudin, do you have a question? Yes, please.
I understand this. I live in New Brighton, and there's one spot in my district where within a block, I think it's the St. Anthony District, Roseville, and then the New Brighton Mounds View, and it's very confusing, and actually for folks moving into the area, they have a particular choice in that area. But my question is, if this were to pass, would all school districts have to follow this this list of how they would accept open enrollment and lottery for students?
Representative Anselmo.
Madam Chair, Representative, that would be the plan here. I mean, this is a priority. You wouldn't have to leave your school district. So if you were in Hopkins, you could still stay and attend that school, and conversely with Minnetonka. So it's just giving you an option of priority that you would not normally have. So you're just trying to give the people that live in those local communities, you know, first pick.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kunshvedi.
Thank you. So I guess what I'm wondering is, how do the school districts feel about this? I'm thinking that maybe school districts have already have a plan in order, and they have a preference of how they would do this. And so my question is this going to remove control from the school districts as far as their lottery system? And are there school districts that are opponents to this?
Well, according to the Department of Education, the only verbiage you can have in your lottery policy is whatever stipulated in the state statute. So when the legislature modified the state statute last year to say that district staff get a priority, well, every district must then, if there's limited capacity and they go to a lottery phase, provide a seat, if there's one available, to a district child or district staff, if that's all that's available. Now, again, if there's more space than applicants, there is no lottery process, and so there's nothing to do. So school boards are not given any discretion, according to the Department of Education, to set their own priority lists. Okay. And so what this allows them to do is just follow along an ordering process. If they have 100 seats to fill and they have 120 applicants, you start with these various categories already stipulated in the law. This would add one more at the bottom. And then once those are all filled, whatever's remaining and seats available, they do a lottery at that point, which is supposed to be random. I think what the legislature has recognized over the past few years is that purely random lotteries aren't necessarily the best outcomes. Mm-hmm. And this is just one thing. You know, there can be better outcomes before you go to completely random, just hypothetically, is having this family be prioritized a better or worse outcome than having someone from a suburb a family six suburbs away? I mean, that's for you to decide, but that's kind of the thinking, is that. And one thing about this amendment is that the Department of Education has been very clear that they don't want any changes to the open enrollment application itself, to make it more difficult for school districts to decide who gets a priority. This would be very easy to administrate because it's all based on your address. So if you were trying to open enroll for New Brighton and they saw New Brighton address, they would know you'd be fitting into a certain priority without having to do any further investigation.
So Representative Anselmo, do you you intend this to be a priority order 1 through 4 with the subs under it? Because if you do, we probably need to include, if we include this in the omnibus bill, some clarifying language that this is the order in which a district would use its lottery. That number one, it would be siblings. Number two, it would be the integration and achievement plan, students who are related to that, and then it would be the district staff. Is that what you intend, Representative Anselmo?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. I just needed to know if we needed some clarifying language, because I'm not sure that the language presently does order it. It says give priority, but sometimes we move from 1 to 5, and sometimes we move from 5 to 1. So I just want to make sure that that this is the intention you have. Mm-hmm. Are there other, Representative Anselmo?
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I'll just leave the question that Representative Pryor had asked before. In the example of Edina, we have about 1,300 open enrollment spaces, and Minneapolis actually takes 500 of those right now. So, they are very well representative, and Edina's done a great job of taking in other districts. It's just, there's been a challenge that former Representative Downey was going to deal with from a whole redistricting standpoint, and we're trying to find the easier, simpler, and maybe a policy that's a little more universal that's just not specific to our community.
And Representative Anselmo, I'll take that as your closing comments, unless you want to add something else.
No, that is it. Thank you very much, Madam
Chair. Thank you. With that, Representative Haley renews her motion that House File 1083 be considered for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you very much. You. Members, our last bill today is the Chair's Bill on Teacher Shortage, and I'd like to call forward Denise Dietrich to be at the table. Members, I'm going to move House File 1663 to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. Members, this file before you is our attempt to provide some innovation for our teacher shortage, which you know is something that we've been experiencing here in Minnesota, and I think across the nation since about the mid-90s. And it's getting to a critical stage now, especially when we consider the ratio that we want in our classrooms between our teachers of color and those who are already in the classroom, who are primarily Caucasian. So this innovative approach would provide for recruitment, for preparation, and for retaining our excellent educators. And I have asked House Research to walk through the details, and then we'll turn to Ms. Dietrich because this is primarily a creation from the School Boards Association. So to the extent, Ms. Pera, that you can keep this kind of concise, we'd appreciate it. You don't have to go into all the detail. This is also eventually going to go to the Finance Committee members, so we're dealing with the policy changes. Please proceed, Ms. Pera.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1663 deals with several areas related to the teacher shortage. One area is the Alternative Teacher Preparation Program, and it changes some of the requirements. Those are in Section 1 through 4. It makes changes to the requirements, the program characteristics, and the process for approval currently by the Board of Teaching. And it also changes the reporting requirements for the Alternative Teacher Preparation Program. And then there are changes also to what is known as QCOMP. That's the alternative compensation. It changes from it's currently called alternative compensation revenue, and it changes from revenue to aid currently, it's revenue divided into aid and levy, and this switches to an all-aid model. It allows currently districts receive $260 per pupil, and that's $169 as state aid and $91 per pupil in the form of equalized levy revenue. And so the total under this bill would remain the same. But $169 per pupil would be for what's called TD&E, that's Teacher Development Evaluation, and $91 for the traditional QCOMP. And that change is phased in. So those changes are in Sections 5 and 6 of the bill. Section 7 has some provisions on the a grant program for the Alternative Teacher Preparation Program. And then there Sections 8 and 9 deal with the Teacher Shortage Loan Forgiveness Program. It expands the definition of teacher shortage to include teachers of color. And it also that's also included in Section 9. It also includes, in Section 10, some reporting on the Teacher Shortage Loan Forgiveness Program. Section 11 deals with a concurrent enrollment. It's a teacher training program. Last year, the legislature passed the Northwest. There's a Northwest Regional Partnership Program that was funded to make sure teachers can get the credits they need to continue to teach concurrent enrollment. As some of you have, as you've heard before, there was clarification in the accreditation standards, and so now high school teachers that teach courses in current enrollment for college credit are required to have at least 18 graduate credits in the subject area that they're teaching. So that program was meant to give teachers an opportunity to do that. It was a relationship between a cooperative service unit and Minnesota State. So this expands that to provide access to teachers throughout Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Pera. The task force would be a discussion for the Committee on Government Operations to which this bill will be re-referred. Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to turn to our first testifier, Ms. Dietrich from the School Boards Association. Would you please say your name for the record and begin?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. As the chair has mentioned, Minnesota, like so many other states in the United States, is experiencing a teacher shortage. In response, MSBA, along with several other education organizations that are all listed on the back of a handout that you have just received, the one that is stapled together, and if you go to the back page, these are all the organizations that have collaborated, contributed, and support this bill. And we have some additions recently. I understand now the Board of Teaching is going to be added to this list. Troy Haugen from LCSC, Career and Technical Education Coordinator, will be added to this list. Jeremy Kovash, Executive Director, Lakes Country Service Cooperative, will be added to this list. And so I think that it is going to continue to grow. So we have joined together to put together the Teacher Shortage Act 2.0. And if you look at this sheet, the colorful sheet like this, you will notice the 2.0. 2.0, you may ask, why is that? Well, we say 2.0 because last year we initiated the original Teacher Shortage Act in which Chair Erickson was our chief author. She was very successful. Many of the provisions in 1.0 were included in the final education omnibus bill. 1.0 was the first step to a very complex, multifaceted problem, but there is still much work to do. And so today we ask for your support of the Teacher Shortage Act 2.0. Today I will give a summary of some of the components that really deal with the policy issues that I think need to be pointed out for this committee, and then I will call on Dr. Kate McGuire of the Osseo Schools to provide some context of what Osseo's teacher shortage looks like and what their school board is doing to address it, and why this bill is important to ultimately their students. As I proceed, I would ask that you would pull out these documents and follow along. But in short, what we need to just emphasize here is that we must, as the chair has mentioned, we must do more to recruit, prepare, and retain teachers for the education workforce of tomorrow. House File 1663 addresses 11 areas. Some are expansions of existing programs, while others are new to the Teacher Shortage Act 2.0. As mentioned, there are some that are expansions of existing programs. For example, Grow Your Own, that was the Teacher Loan Forgiveness Program. The Student Teacher Stipends in Shortage Areas, a finance piece that has been added is a 3% administrative fee allowable to the Office of Higher Education to implement this program. Student teaching is a full-time job in and of itself, and so many of the students who are look at going on their student teaching adventure, they realize they may need to quit the job that they have already in college. And quitting the job for student teachers is not always an option. So House File 1663 increases that grant program and, as I mentioned, allows for the Office of Higher Education some money to administer this very important program, which is a barrier to especially students of color. So we also provide some funding for the administration of portfolio processing. That is really important to our out-of-state teachers. They a lot of times come into the state and they want to license via portfolio. And this is a very high administrative cost program to execute. And so instead of just admiring the problem, we are going to fund it. And then principal leadership. We already have a Minnesota Principals Academy in the state of Minnesota. We are asking that this organization, along with any others who provide this type of training, could recruit teachers of color, principals of color, to be in the program. The Christina House Research has already talked about the QComp program. I firmly believe that this is one of the biggest inequities in the state to providing a workplace where teachers can flourish. And so currently, as you've heard testimony in other committees, currently one-third of the school districts and half of the charter schools benefit from the $168 per pupil that QComp school districts do. QComp, I just think it's really important to note, especially in the policy committee, that QComp may be used for professional learning communities, induction programs, mentorship programs, strengthening the TDE process. All those things contribute to a workplace where teachers feel valued and supported, and this should be a program that is expanded statewide. The concurrent enrollment program, as you know, 76% of Minnesota's 1,400 concurrent enrollment teachers need to acquire anywhere from 1 to 18 credits in order to keep their accreditation by 2020. This last year we implemented the online 18 program. This program is cost effective. It can be rolled out statewide, and it can move teachers into the future of continuing in the future to be qualified to teach concurrent enrollment. The new pieces is one of them is a statewide marketing campaign. What we believe is that we need to start changing the narrative about teaching. We need it to, instead of a narrative of be a teacher, get paid a little for a very tough job, the message should be a teacher, work with kids, make a difference in a kid's life, make a decent living, potentially retire on a good pension, and enjoy some time off in the summer months. Then the alternative preparation grants, this committee has dealt with this in the teacher licensure bill, so I won't touch on that too much, but we have people in the audience who would answer those questions if need be. The Collaborative Urban and Greater Minnesota Educators Program. This, it is the state's intention to increase and diversify the teachers' workforce. We have five institutions in the state of Minnesota who are currently doing this. This bill is really important because it expands the program to include Metropolitan State University, who has been tasked with this work from the Minnesota legislature in the year 2000. They are actually right now enrolling the most teacher candidates of color than any program in the state. And so we include them in this program. And just as a side note, because we've talked about leadership, Metro State also has the most diverse faculty and staff. And our testifier here will speak to that today. And then we create a teacher shortage task force to review supply and demand trends in education and explore data and make recommendations for the legislature. So that is a very brief policy-oriented view of the bill. Now I will call on Dr. Kate McGuire, Superintendent of Osseo Schools.
Welcome, Dr. McGuire. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kate McGuire, and I serve as the Superintendent of Osseo Area Schools. I'll testify in House File 1663. Thank you for the opportunity to advocate for the transformational change that's necessary to really make a difference on this particular issue. I appreciate Representative Erickson's leadership in this issue. Like all good teachers, I'll start with the end in mind. My intended outcome is that you'll be encouraged to create the transformational change that's necessary to really make a difference here. And to that end, I'll share the journey of our school district in trying to recruit and retain a racially diverse teacher workforce. I'll share the results that we have. And lastly, I'll urge you to take some courageous action on this item during this legislative session. I want to provide some context first, though. Osseo Area Schools is the fifth largest school district in the state of Minnesota, serving more than 20,000 students in the northwest quadrant of the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area. 55% of our students, of our 20,000 students, are students of color. We serve the third highest number of students of color in the state of Minnesota. We serve the second highest number of Asian Pacific Islander students in the state. 11 of our schools are identified as racially segregated, isolated schools. Our data shows us that students who are not yet meeting our very highest expectations on key metrics are largely predictable by race. Parents of color in our school communities have implored us to increase the number of staff of color in our schools. And I provide that context to you to help you understand that for Osseo Area Schools, this issue is not one that we take lightly, nor have we waited around for others to take action. Recruiting and retaining a workforce that better reflects the demographics of our students has been a strategic school board priority for several years. Here are the results of our efforts. Over the past 5 years, we have increased the percentage of administrators of color by 10%. We've increased the percentage of support staff of color by 5%. We've increased the percentage of licensed teachers of color by only 1%. With input from community members of color, here's the action we've already taken to attain those results. We've developed metrics to track our progress. We've revised job descriptions. We've streamlined the job application process. We've improved screening and selection processes. We've invested in leadership development. We've enhanced marketing efforts, including hosting community job fairs with community members of color. We've embarked on a systemic racial equity journey to improve school climate and to impact administrative and teacher practice. We've integrated the work of our QComp instructional coaches, our staff development specialists, and our equity team members in order to provide a really streamlined and coherent network of support for our teachers. We've created 15 summer paid internships for high school students. We've recruited college students to serve as servant leader interns for our Freedom School summer programs. We hired a recruitment specialist. We hosted employee racial affinity groups. We've revised multiple collective bargaining groups. Bargaining agreements to enable paid leaves of absences without reduction in wages or benefits for current employees to complete student teaching in our school district and to allow those employees to carry some limited seniority from the non-licensed bargaining groups to the teacher bargaining groups once they're hired as teachers in our school district. And recently, we've entered into a groundbreaking partnership with Metropolitan State University as part of our Career Ladder Plan. The Career Ladder creates a pathway for high school students to be employed as summer interns, allows them to get a job in a support staff position after they've graduated from high school. It allows them to receive preferred entrance into the teacher preparation program at Metropolitan State, receive full pay and benefits while student teaching, receive first consideration for teacher vacancies in the district, and earn up to 2 years of additional seniority once they've received continuing contract status. Whew. Easy as pie. No state grants, no extra help, just our internal determined efforts. So I want to repeat the results of those efforts. Over the past 5 years, we've increased the percentage administrators of color by 10% because of those efforts. We've increased the percentage of support staff of color by 5%, and we've only increased the licensed teachers of color by 1%, even after all of those efforts. And so while those efforts have led to some change in the racial demographics of our district's workforce, our experience provides evidence that ensuring the number of qualified teachers and increasing the number of teachers of color and American Indian educators will require a systemic, statewide policy framework. And the House File 1663 is a great starting point for that strategic framework. The paraprofessional pathway provision, obviously, is key. However, the eligibility criteria has to be changed to include people who do not yet have bachelor's degrees in order to include programs like ours. The provision adding Metropolitan State and other programs to the list of recipients for the Educators of Color programs is critical. The student teaching provision, which provides grants to teachers entering shortage areas, will alleviate a key barrier to professional entrance. The teacher loan forgiveness provision will increase funding to address needs of teachers with loan debt. The alternative compensation aid provision that expands QComp will enable other school districts to create the kind of teacher development network that we've created in our school district to support and retain effective teachers. The task force could centralize the work to do research and recommend policy change on this issue. I do want you to know that I have two key concerns about provisions of this bill and would strongly recommend consideration for the following revisions to make this framework even more powerful to support our district's efforts. The paraprofessional pathways provision must be expanded to include other employee groups and to eliminate the bachelor's degree as eligibility criteria. Secondly, the task force must be directed to conduct some research before investing in a marketing campaign. It's my perspective that we're not going to accomplish our goal by enticing adults to change careers. We're going to get the number of teachers we need by enticing youth to enter the profession, and youth voice must be included in the research to inform marketing initiatives. Overall, House File 1663 is a great starting point for a statewide policy framework that's necessary for this change. Maintaining Minnesota's quality of life will require a well-educated workforce, and that workforce depends on effective schools and effective teachers. We know that effective teachers of all races and ethnicity who are culturally responsive are essential to ensuring that all students achieve at high levels. And we know that increasing the number of teachers of color and American Indian educators in Minnesota is strategic action to improve student achievement. I urge you to take courageous action on behalf of our students so that this generation of children will live in a Minnesota that is free from the burden of disparity in employment, healthcare, home ownership, and academic outcomes that are currently predictable by race.
Thank you, Dr. McGuire. That was very well done. Two great testifiers to support this proposal. Very good. I think we need to hear from concerns now because we're running out of time. So I'd like the Office of Higher Ed, who has a concern, and the Board of Teaching, who has a concern, to come forward to express their concerns. If they are duplicative of what Dr. McGuire mentioned, the task force, remember, will be discussed in government operations. But if it's the same about the paraprofessionals and eliminating the BA, we do have an amendment that will come forward later when this bill moves. So welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education.
Thank you. Welcome. And please proceed with your testimony.
I also have Megan Fitzgibbon. She's a manager for our financial aid and a program manager, and she manages most of the teacher programs we've been assigned. Before she begins on some of the concerns, I just wanted to say that for the appropriations, we appreciate adding the admin to the student teacher grants, but for some of these, we would prefer it not be a transfer and just be appropriated directly to our office.
And that's something we'll discuss in education finance.
All right.
So we'll just talk about policy. So if our other testifier would just focus on policy, please. Please say your name for the record.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Megan Fitzgibbon with the Office of Higher Education. And Madam Chair, we just have a few concerns about the way the language is in the Teacher Shortage Loan Forgiveness Program, which is really a repayment program for teachers. And we have just embarked in the last week. We'll start making the first awards for this program that was established in 2015. And the first issue we have is on line 9.29. where there's an addition of the economic development regions where there's a shortage of licensed teachers who reflect the racial and ethnic diversity of students in the region. We just think it might be a good idea to add some language there that says that it's as defined by the Commissioner of Education. It's not exactly clear where those definitions would come from in the way the law is written or the amendment's written.
Thank you.
And then the other concern we had was with the effective date. If this were to become effective, say, in May or even April, that would be in the middle of when we are starting to collect applications for the second round of awards, and this could make that difficult if we had to change the application or add things to the application, so it would be better if the effective date was later, say July 1 or August 1.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And the I think the other thing that we had a concern about, we addressed in the first section. So.
Thank you very much. Very kind of you to come today and to be so specific, because that's what we really look for when we're walking through a proposal is, for you to, and that's for all testifiers, hone in on where it is we can improve this bill or make some kind of correction. So thank you very much for coming. I'll call Cindy Christ from MACD. And is the Board of Teaching also? Yes, please come forward, both of you. And try to be as specific as the last testifiers were in regard to how we can make this proposal work for us. Let's take the Board of Teaching first, because I think I called you first. So please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Alex Liuzzi. I'm a teacher education specialist at the Board of Teaching. Have a big passion for this issue, so I'll try not to speak too quickly, though. We have really no concerns with this bill. We support the intent and the direction of this bill. Really, these are just suggestions, minor suggestions to clarify some language to help sort of improve some of the pieces that are already in the bill. There's just a couple small ones. Under Section 14, Subdivision 8, we would recommend that the Collaborative Urban Education Program be a competitive grant for all programs instead of singling out some and then the other half, a competitive grant program. In many of the areas, with House File 140 moving forward and Senate File 4 creating a Professional Educator Standards and Licensing Board, as Madam Chair knows quite well, we recommend that issues related to supply and demand be under the jurisdiction of that new board. Don't know how that works within legislation of giving jurisdiction to a board that does not exist yet and hasn't passed through the process, but that would be a suggestion to align the pieces in this bill with those other bills moving forward, specifically House File 140. The bigger area that we want to focus on is Section 1 and Section 7. So we really believe that to build the necessary workforce, that is the intent of this bill, of trained, qualified, licensed teachers, alternative preparation really needs to be a key piece and has been a struggle for many years since this initial statute was moved forward. Our recommendations are in two key places, and we've been working with stakeholders, both Troy Haugen at part of the CT task force and Ed Allies, to restructure that first statute to meet one primary objective, and that is alternative pathways should not have a lower or higher standard than conventional providers and conventional programs. We really we have language that has been developed that we can propose that would create a same set of standards and processes and just keep and maintain Subdivision 3 there that requires the board to consider non-traditional means to meet those standards. We think the way that the statute written right now has been confusing and made it difficult for alternative providers to move forward through the approval process. And then in Section 7, we work daily with alternative organizations that want to become alternative providers. These are staff that have full-time jobs that do not have the ability to spend the time needed to go through that process. So we really support in Section 7 to create that startup funding and direct it for these alternative preparation programs. And it's really just some minor language changes to how that money is directed and where it's directed within Section 7. We look forward to providing those recommendations in detail. We have all of this written out, and we're working with you as this bill moves forward. So thank you very much.
And please submit those to us. Thank you very much for your testimony. Ms. Crist, please introduce yourself and begin.
Madam Chair, Member Cindy Crist with the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. First of all, let me say that we're very pleased to see the requested funding for teacher shortage loan forgiveness and student teacher and shortage area grants. We frankly think that the best approach to fix teacher shortage is to put money directly in the hands of prospective and practicing teachers. And that comes from somebody who represents a lot of public institutions that would love to be funded. But we think giving those individuals the funding is the best way to fix this problem. We also are very pleased to see the expansion of Q funding to potentially include additional colleges and universities so long as they can demonstrate that they meet the same goals. We have one very small request, and that is that you consider identifying MACD as the entity to name a teacher prep member to the Teacher Shortage Task Force. This would be consistent with every other organization represented, and it would ensure that somebody from a college or university would be named. Sometimes when the language reads the way it does now, a system administrator, as like I used to be, would be the person named, and we think there should be a faculty or administrator from one of our programs serving just as all the other groups identified.
So
that's Section 13.
So, Ms. Crist, you'd want to testify in government operations what this is for.
Yeah. Thank you. We do have a couple of concerns, and they're somewhat consistent with what you just heard from Alex Luzzi from the Board of Teaching. We're concerned about the removal of any degree requirement for licensure on lines 2.1 to 2.3. We understand that for some CTE licenses, for example, an associate degree might be appropriate, but we're concerned that there would be no degree requirement. As Alex said also, we didn't coordinate our testimony at all, but we would also like to see the attention to all programs be on much more of a level playing field with other programs in terms of the kinds of outcomes you want them to achieve. And I'll give one specific example, reporting. And not in this bill, but House Bill 140, there's a long list, most of which is currently in statute, about all kinds of things that teacher prep programs need to report. It seems to us that alternative programs should have to meet those same reporting requirements so that they can tell you how students are doing, where they're being placed, program satisfaction, and so on. The language on reporting requirements right now for all programs is on lines 9.9 to 9.12. We also wonder about the funding for alternative prep programs. This is probably more a question for finance, so I won't go into any details. But just, you know, we wonder why non-Minnesota entities might be eligible, and we would love you to consider the possibility that if traditional providers could come forward with experimental programs that would meet the standards here, that they would be potentially eligible. They couldn't come up with something interesting and experimental, they wouldn't get the funding, but, you know, potentially available or eligible. And then finally, I'd echo comments made by the Office of Higher Ed. You may know that on the marketing campaign, you may know that the Bush Foundation, as part of their five-year project focused on teacher preparation, did fund a marketing effort. I don't know very much about how effective that was, but at the very least I would suggest that if there's going to be a marketing campaign, that before they embark on anything, they talk to the folks at the Bush Foundation, get their assessment of what worked and what didn't, and then take that into consideration before spending state funding for a marketing campaign.
Thank you very much. Finally, we have Teach for America. Please come forward.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members.
Good morning. Say your name for the record and begin. Yes.
My name is Mary Koflik. I'm the Director of Alumni Strategy and Impact for Teach for America Twin Cities. Teach for America works in partnership with communities to expand educational opportunities for children facing the challenges of poverty. We've been operating in Minnesota since 2009 as a nonprofit recruiting and developing new teachers and a proud member of the AmeriCorps National Service Network. 36% of our graduates locally identify as a person of color or coming from a low-income background, and we are one of the largest teacher development organizations working with teachers of color in the nation. We are working closely with the Board of Teaching at Allies and other stakeholders to clarify and clean up the language of 122A.245 to ensure that we create an alternative teacher preparation approval process that's rigorous, transparent, and allows organizations such as ours and others to operate sustainably across our state to serve the dramatic shortages in both licensure area and geographic location that exist. We believe supporting many different and rigorous pathways to the classroom, including alternative, conventional, and non-conventional, will serve to broaden access to the profession and increase teacher diversity, as well as improve student outcomes. We're eager to continue to collaborate with stakeholders to clarify this statute to ensure long-term sustainability of all pathways, including alternative routes to the classroom to better serve Minnesota students. Finally, Teach for America supports the competitive grant program proposed because we believe it provides a necessary state investment to encourage such programs to actually apply for unit approval, as we haven't yet seen in our state. Teach for America would consider very seriously its ability to seek unit approval if this program were passed, which would create the long-term sustainability necessary to expand our organization, potentially both in cohort size and in geographic area we serve. We would welcome other organizations as well, serving in high-need schools or geographic shortage areas to apply for approval, as well as to promote and serve educational equity across our state. I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today and look forward to the discussion.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kozlik. Members, this is a work in progress, and I know we're not going to have time to ask questions, but I am going to move this to government operations because of the time. But tomorrow we're going to have many of the same persons in the audience. So please feel free to ask this author any questions that may have arisen today as we move this along, or submit them to me. So with that, members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1663 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is moved to Government Operations. Members, tomorrow we begin at 9 o'clock in room 10, so we'll be right here, and we'll be closing off our policy discussions, I believe, tomorrow, so we can launch on Monday. We'll release our delete all for the policy bill, and Tuesday have the walkthrough and testimony, and then Thursday the amendments and finalize this. So we have lots ahead of us. Thank you, members, very much for being engaged, and thank those who came to testify. The meeting